It's my great pleasure this morning to introduce Claire Lockhart. Claire is the co-founder and director of the Institute for State Effectiveness, and she'll tell you more about that. She has really, in a very short time, become a pivotal player in the world, advising countries, states, international organizations regarding the enormously important and complicated problem of how to establish effective states, effective civil society institutions, working democracies, working markets in countries, regions where the state has failed or where there is not yet any kind of functioning state, where there is no history of democratic institutions or civil society, or where they have suffered as a result of civil and ethnic conflict. And if you look at many of the problems in the world today, so many of them are rooted in this problem. And indeed, so many of the problems in these states are exported around the world with tragic consequence. She played a pivotal role from 2001 to 2005, after 9/11, to the establishment of a working government in Afghanistan. She was an advisor for the United Nations to the Bonn Agreement, which set up the modern Afghanistan. She has also worked with the United Nations and the World Bank and focused very much on these enormously challenging problems. She and Ashraf Ghani, who was the finance minister in Afghanistan after 9/11, established the Institute for State Effectiveness to work not just in Afghanistan, but many other similarly threatened and threatening contexts around the world. She and Ashraf have just continued a round-the-world book tour for this wonderful book, which she will hold up, Fixing Failed States. And again, I think probably, Claire, did Oxford University Press choose this title, The Failed States? I mean,
yes.
One of the issues is it's actually the work that Claire and Ashraf do is effective in many places other than where there are failed states. There are many places in the world, as you know, where there are no states at all, or where there have been states, but they have not been effective or not democratic. And what I'm especially delighted about is that Claire and Ashraf are about to become part of the Aspen Institute in a formal fashion. We will be establishing a new policy program of the Aspen Institute focusing on one critical aspect of this challenge, which is how to build markets in these failed or non-existent states, with the notion being, not the notion, but the reality being that in the absence of market mechanisms, these states have very little chance of success. And we are delighted about this at the Aspen Institute for many, many reasons. First of all, the importance of this work, not just in Afghanistan, but in sadly many, many places around the world and in almost every continent. But also because in a real sense, it brings the Aspen Institute back to one of the things that was important at its inception. When Walter Pepke established the Aspen Institute more than 60 years ago, one of the focuses at that time, it was in the context of the Cold War, was to assure that the leaders in this country had a firm understanding of the underpinnings of markets and democracies, believing that there was a battle that was going to go on, an ideological and intellectual battle for minds with state-controlled economies and market economies. And in a real sense, the work that Claire is going to be doing at the Aspen Institute with convenings here and around the world is going to bring us back to that very important work, understanding the basis of the market system and particularly how to build markets where they haven't existed before. So with that, I think you're going to find this fascinating, and Claire is going to become a regular part of the Institute going forward. Thank you.
Elliot, thank you very much for a generous introduction and for inviting me and my colleagues to establish an intellectual partnership with Aspen, which I think is going to be incredibly valuable and productive going forwards, and to all of you for making a 7:45 a.m. start, which is heroic, to say the least. I'm here to talk about fixing failed states. The story starts in Afghanistan, 2001. A group of us, and my colleague Ashraf Ghani, who isn't here today but is really indispensable to this whole project, and my co-author, were assembled shortly after September 11. And we sat around a table, and Mr. Brahimi, Lakhdar Brahimi, who was the negotiator for the UN Bonn Agreement that set up the government in Afghanistan, and a few others sat around the table and thought, well, there's going to be a US invasion into Afghanistan, and that's it's going to happen, and it's legitimate. But in the past, the part that we've all done really badly is establish a peaceful situation afterwards, a functioning government afterwards. And we began to think, well, what are we going to do? And we asked the UN, where are your manuals on how to build peace agreements? And they said, we don't have any manuals. So we went to the World Bank and we said, where are your manuals on how to set up ministries of finance? We don't have any manuals. We went to UNICEF, how do you build education systems? We don't know. And it turned out that after 50 years of the aid system and all those billions of dollars poured into trying to establish functioning systems, nobody had written it down. Nobody had worked out how to decode things. So a group of us sat around the table and began to think about it. We thought, well, we're going to need a currency. Who shall we ask? So we called up Paul Volcker, and he said, sure, I'll come and help. And he came and figured out, well, this is how I think you change a currency. We're going to need a budget. We're going to need a treasury. And we called on the generosity of a number of people, and they began to figure it out from first principles. From there, we went to Bonn, and a group of Afghans came out of Afghanistan and from different parts around the world and put together a tentative plan. Mr. Brahimi said, I don't think we're going to get a plan, an agreement at all. At the most, we might get an agreement to go to Kabul to negotiate. But somehow, I think it was probably because it was Ramadan and people wanted to get home. In 2 weeks, there was an agreement. I then went out to Peshawar to see amongst the Afghan NGOs where the good leaders were who might make good cabinet ministers. And then a few weeks later, we stood in the rubble after the fall of the Taliban in Afghanistan and thought, where do we begin? The lights were out in the ministries. The power wasn't working. Central heating was down. It was freezing. And nobody knew what to do. I spent the next 4 years with my colleagues trying to figure out how exactly do you build a functioning government. And we did a number of things. We started off thinking, well, we have a chairman, President Karzai. Well, we need a cabinet. We need a currency. We need a budget. We need resources for the budget. We need to pay the civil servants, and so on. We did a number of things. Some things did work. One of those things was the change of the currency. The IMF and the World Bank thought, well, it'll take you at least 15,000 international bureaucrats to come and help you change the currency. Ashraf thought, well, that doesn't sound right. They said, it's going to take you 2 years. So we haven't got 2 years. So what did he do? He called in the hawala dealers from the money market and said, could you guys do this? And they went, sure, we could do it in 3 months. They did it in 4. We thought one of the next problems was nobody could communicate with each other because the landlines were down and everybody was using satellite phones, which were incredibly expensive, so if they could afford them. The UN came along and said, well, if you pay tens of millions of dollars to Ericsson, they could provide 100 free phones and you could have as many free calls as you wanted and you could give those phones to the ambassadors. And Ashraf said, that doesn't sound right. So he did a tender process and licensed in a competitive way a number of firms, and there are now 4 million mobile phones across the country in Afghanistan. Another challenge, how do you get money out to the villages? We thought if the UN agencies and the NGOs came in to do all the work, it would be incredibly expensive. And I'll come on a bit later to why we think the aid complex just can't work in these contexts. So instead we thought, how do we get money straight out to villages? The villages have been pretty self-sufficient. They've survived the last 23 years of war, so they know what to do. But we just need to get additional resources to them. So what we did was pool the money from the donors in a trust fund, and Jim Wolfenson from the World Bank was great. He came and put $100 million on the table to start with, and then gave a block grant to every village in the country. And there were 3 rules that enabled a village to access the money. They had to have a village council, and they choose how they have the village council. And in 99 times out of 100, they choose to have a secret ballot election because they think that's the best way to choose their council. But it's their decision. It's not a Western imposition. And the second rule A quorum of the village must come together to choose their projects, men and women. And if the men don't want the women in the same room, then they have to split the money in two and have two separate councils, and they normally don't choose that. And the third rule, they have to put their accounts up in a public place. And it can't be behind the desk of the headman. It has to be out on a tree or somewhere outside so that everybody can see it. And this program is now in 32,000 villages. And last November, representatives from all these villages, we couldn't fit 32,000 people in the Loyajega tent, so each cluster of villages had to send somebody, and 700 people came together. And they said, for the National Convention of Communities, and they said, well, we're the government of Afghanistan because we're the people. And you cabinet ministers, this is what we need you to do for us. And it's been tremendously exciting to watch programs like this come to fruition, and gives me great hope that whatever you call it, whether it's nation building or state building or development, really is possible. And there are wonderful stories coming out of this program. When we go to the villages, sometimes the women say, you know, it's not the money. The money's great, please don't take it away, but it's the fact that we get to make decisions we've never been allowed to make decisions before. Our government trusts us to make decisions. Other things that are happening are the villages are coming together spontaneously. So 35 villages got together and they said, look, our main problem is that our women are dying in childbirth. So we need a maternity hospital. So they decided the best thing they could do was pool all their grants in one pot. And then they put a woman in charge of building a maternity hospital. Another set of villages decided, well, we want to get the irrigation system going so we can grow our pomegranates. I think there's a great partnership potentially in the pomegranate business between Afghanistan and Aspen. That might be one of the starting points for the Aspen market building program. And 187 of them got together to build an irrigation system. So some really wonderful stories that give one great hope that all this is possible. But after a while, it became evident that the state building project in Afghanistan wasn't going to work in the situation as it stood. And we hit a roadblock. And what was that roadblock about? One of the problems was unique to the geopolitical situation of Afghanistan, and it was that a number of warlords had been empowered in the struggle on the war on terror, so maybe legitimate reasons. But the effect of this was that these warlords were continuing to receive resources and support to maintain their own militias. From the coalition governments, so the US and the UK, and they were being paid and encouraged to maintain militias, which meant several things. These big men got bigger and bigger, and they got a little bit out of hand. These were the reason the Taliban, one of the main reasons the Taliban came in the first place, these commanders, because while they might be fairly good at maintaining militias, they're not so good at obeying the rule of law. And they're responsible for a lot of the rape and pillage and disorder that the population really can't stand. One of the consequences was when the government trained up customs officers and sent them out to the borders to collect customs to pay its doctors and teachers, those customs officers were getting killed on the borders by those militias. So it wasn't possible for the government to raise its own taxes. The second reason that the state-building agenda became really impossible was actually the behavior of the aid system, what we in our book call the aid complex. While the NGOs and the UN agencies and the contractors are full of very well-meaning, hard-working people who often give up much higher salaries in other places, they give up spending time with their family to go and serve in these places. And while many of these individual NGOs are doing fantastic work, the combined effect is to cause really system gridlock. Back in 2002, the donors put $20 million into a trust fund, which was to pay for 260,000 civil servants in place, so the doctors, the teachers, the policemen. $20 million to pay for 260,000 civil servants for the year. At the same time, they put $2.7 billion into the UN agency system, which had seven people on the ground at the time. And what was the net effect of this? Anybody who was educated in Afghanistan, who'd stayed with the country, who spoke a bit of English and had a college degree, who might be working as a doctor or a teacher or an engineer or a finance manager, The government couldn't afford to pay their salaries for $50 a month. So what did they do? They left their positions and they took jobs working as drivers and assistants and translators for all these thousands of projects run by the UN agency system. Drivers were being paid $1,000 a month. So you can't blame any of these individuals. But what happened, therefore, was really an exercise in state destruction. The doctors, engineers, and teachers left to become drivers, assistants, and translators for an aid system that couldn't work, because they were meant to be doing capacity building for the schools and hospitals that were now empty. The reformers knew they'd hit a roadblock because they couldn't keep going under these conditions. They literally ran out of money. They were having to run to places like Oman and Pakistan from month to month to beg or borrow $1 million just to be able to keep paying the wages. And with very heavy hearts, they decided, well, they wrote a memo that went to Washington and 10 Downing Street to explain, we can't continue to do state building because the government's run out of money and we need $200 million to keep the effort going. So back in 2004, it would have taken $200 million to get Afghanistan right. They decided to leave. This book, in part, is an effort to try and explain why these situations go wrong and what needs to be done from the external environment to help reformers when they need to rebuild their countries. It was actually an event at Aspen in 2004 where a colleague and I realized that there's an immense amount of intellectual capital of thinking in the communities in America, outside Washington. So in the corporations, in the universities, in public intellectuals. And we thought that we really needed engagement with this type of community to try and reimagine how development assistance could take place. So the last couple of years, Ashraf and I have been looking at a number of different countries. We thought if we wrote a book just about Afghanistan, people would say, well, Afghanistan's unique. It's fine in other countries. We didn't think that was the case. So we went to southern Sudan, to Kosovo, to Nepal. We've studied the situation in Liberia, in Haiti. And we found that the situation in a lot of these places is very similar. And I'll talk a little bit about our findings now. First, what goes wrong? What could go right? How could we do it differently? And what a framework would look like for thinking about it differently? So starting with what goes wrong, I've described a little bit about what goes wrong in the case of Afghanistan. And to me, actually, it was best explained by a group of Afghans in 2002. I visited a remote province in Afghanistan, in Bamiyan, a remote corner of Bamiyan. And some villagers said to me, I want to tell you a story. And I said, sure. And they said, look, we're illiterate, but we're not stupid. Would you sit down? And I said, with pleasure. And they said, we're going to tell you the story of $150 million going up in smoke. And I said, okay. And they said, look, we heard on our radio that a $150 million program was coming to our area, and we were so excited because we thought that this would transform our lives. And then a few months later, we heard that this program had been completed, and we were rather surprised because our lives hadn't really changed. So we went to find out what had happened. So they became forensic accountants. And they said, well, what we think happened is the following. $150 million went to UNHCR in Geneva, and they took 20% for overheads. And then it got subcontracted to CARE, and 20% went to Washington. And then it got subcontracted again to Oxfam, and 20% went to Oxford for overheads. Then it got subcontracted again, and so on. And they said a little bit of money was left. And this was used to procure wood from Western Iran, even though we have our own forests here. And this wood was shipped via a governor's trucking cartel at five times the normal price for shipping. And eventually a few wooden beams reached our villages. And these wooden beams were far too big for the mud walls that we can build. So all we could do is chop it up and use it for firewood. And that, they said, is the story of $150 million going up in smoke. Now, that's an extreme example. But having gone across the country in Afghanistan, it's a pretty typical example. And the glossy brochures that are produced in London and Paris and Washington are full of these pictures of these projects. But on the ground, the people are going, where's the money? And I went around the country again last year with General Richards, who was running the ISAF NATO mission. And across the country, what I found was that people weren't really angry about the bombing. Afghans can be very philosophical about that. They say, yeah, this is collateral damage, we understand, and we'd so much rather have America here than Russia or Pakistan. So we want this strategic partnership with America. But we can't stand this waste and corruption in the aid system. You promised us you'd rebuild our country, but look at what you're doing. Another example, I was working in the Prime Minister's compound in Kabul, which is where a lot of the projects were being procured. And one day a man came, and he was wearing a beautiful turban. He had a long beard and long robes, and he'd come a very long way with his manuscript. And he'd written out a bid for one of the projects in beautiful calligraphy. But he'd been turned away at the gate because he wasn't wearing a suit and he hadn't typed up his application. So instead, all the projects were going to German firms and Chinese firms and Turkish firms, whereas the traders and the businessmen in Afghanistan were being shut out of the reconstruction process. So what's wrong with this? We describe this aid complex, that billions of dollars are put into the system, not just in Afghanistan, but in all these other countries, these so-called failed or failing or fragile states. But the system isn't working. The system isn't working, one, because of these number of contractual layers, even if it's not quite as bad as the situation with the logs and the smoke. Often these projects have 3 or 4 or 5 contractual layers, so that a school that the villages could build through the National Solidarity Program for $30,000 or $40,000 will cost the American taxpayer $250,000 or $300,000 just by going through all these layers. The second problem is that these projects have the wrong relationships of accountability. So if you live in a village and your school, its roof falls in or the teacher's illiterate, who do you complain to? The person responsible for the project is living in Tokyo or in Berlin or in Washington. So the relationship of you can't go and complain to your mayor in the town hall or the town council because the relationship of accountability is broken. Another problem, there are so many different agencies involved. So there are probably around 20 or 30 UN agencies. In Afghanistan, there were 3,000 NGOs and so on, and each of them doing their own projects. So soon enough, you've got something like 10,000 or 20,000 small projects, and nobody can keep track of them. And it really causes this system gridlock. Another problem, we rely very much on something that the aid system calls technical assistance, which, when done well, can be absolutely brilliant. I'll come on to it in a bit, but when Lee Kuan Yew was rebuilding Singapore, he relied on one advisor, a Dutchman, who used to come and have a chat with him every few months or so, and gave him absolutely brilliant ideas. But the technical assistance industry that's now been developed costs us billions of dollars a year. It's not regulated. It's not very well monitored. So it tends to place individuals from other countries in the country supposedly to advise them. But what actually happens? In Afghanistan, the UN and the World Bank said to the government, look, the Millennium Development Goals are really important. I agree, they are really important. One of them says primary education is a goal. And what the UN and the World Bank said was, you must only have primary education. You're not allowed to put any money into secondary or tertiary education. And the government said, well, then where are we going to get our doctors and teachers from if we can only educate people to age 11? And they said, too bad, this is what the Millennium Development Goals say. So no money was put into secondary or tertiary education or vocational training. And then 3 years later, the donors say, the Afghans, they don't have any capacity, so they're now spending $1 billion a year on technical assistance. This problem is the same in other countries. In Kosovo, for example, 80 cents on the dollar of all the aid money of the last 5 years has gone to technical assistance, and virtually nothing to the universities or the vocational training schools. So a common sight in Kosovo is to see young Kosovars in their early 20s standing on the street corners just smoking with nothing to do, whereas the ministries are full of people from New Zealand and Australia and America and the UK doing the jobs that these young people should be doing. So I think we have, again, a really systemic problem here. We've failed across the world to invest in vocational, professional training for the people of the countries. And instead, we're spending billions of dollars to bring people in to do their jobs and not do it very well. A common sight is to see a foreigner sitting in a ministry getting their arithmetic wrong and telling the locals that they don't know what the case is. And it's usually, in our findings, that the technical assistance isn't getting it right. So we have a huge problem in the aid complex. I think we're beginning to see some change. At top level in all the ministries across the world, people are saying, we have a problem here, we have to change. But I think it's going to be a good 10, 20 years before that change gets into the system, because it's really an interest group. It's not quite the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned about, but it's a kind of aid complex of a similar nature. Moving on now, do we have grounds for hope, or should we just despair? What we set out to argue is that we absolutely have grounds for hope. We see two schools of despair. There's one school of despair which says we just have to pull out, and we see that in the debate about Iraq. And then there's the other school of thought which says that nation building and state building is a messy and complex process, which it is. And look at Europe, it takes 300 years. So we might as well give up. I don't think we can give up, because we can't collectively tolerate a world where there are 40 to 60 countries that have no governance, because it's in these places that the breeding grounds develop, whether for disease, for terrorism, for instability, and a number of other of our problems. So we don't have that option. But rather, I do think we have ground for hope. And what we did in the last few years is look at a number of cases where transformation has happened successfully. One of those group of stories is actually about the transformation of corporations. A number of leaders who come into a collapsed or deeply troubled corporation, a firm, and managed to transform it. But the cases we looked at in most detail were places where countries were transformed. And we looked at Singapore. Back in the early 1960s, Singapore was considered not to be a viable country. There was an Australian journalist who said, look, it really isn't going to survive. Lee Kuan Yew writes in his autobiography that the odds of survival were against us. And I think we sometimes forget that these were the origins of Singapore. And Lee Kuan Yew and his team of people managed to transform Singapore into one of the really dynamic financial centers of today. We looked at Ireland, one of the poorest countries in Europe in the 1980s, and now one of the richest. We looked at Spain and how it managed to transform itself since the time of Franco by building a coalition across the Franco team and the new team, really to create Spain as one of the most, again, dynamic and prosperous places in Europe. And we looked at the states of the American South, a number of places which have transformed from a place where in the 1960s Governor George Wallace was able to say segregation today, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever, and endemic poverty to a set of states which are, again, amongst the most thriving in the US today. And we looked at how these leaders got it right, and we found a number of things. And the first was really the importance of leadership. In each of these places, a team of leaders came together and decided, we're going to get this right. And they had a long-term vision, somewhere between 10 and 20 years. And they said, look, this is where we want to get to. We don't know exactly all the steps along the way, but we're going to figure it out. And they had a large degree of flexibility along the way. And it was never just a leader, a single leader, even though that's sometimes how history writes it up. And I think often we look for the charismatic hero rather than the team of people who need to come together. Second thing that they did was absolute relentless focus on public finance and accountability. And I think, again, this is something we often overlook. In post-conflict situations where the diplomats are in charge, I think diplomats often see accountants as rather boring people who need to be in the backroom. Accountancy is a backroom function. But accountability is really, really central. I argued sometimes that what we need is accountants, not policemen, in post-conflict situations. Lee Kuan Yew writes in his autobiography of when he visited Washington, and he said to his aide, "When I get back to Singapore, I'm going to build an aviary." And they were at the zoo at the time. And his aide said, "Why an aviary? Why don't you build a zoo?" And Lee Kuan Yew said, "Because bird seed is much cheaper than meat. And at the moment, we can only afford bird seed." When we interviewed the leaders in Spain who were responsible for the transition, the transformation of Spain in the 70s and 80s, again, they said the first thing they did was make sure that they had their Ministry of Finance and all its accountabilities and systems up and running, because they knew that was going to be the basis for building a functioning system. The third thing that emerged in all these places was a decision that for stability, the leadership needed to invest in a middle class. That it wasn't enough just to have a small elite responsible. They needed to broaden. They needed to expand the pie and broaden the participation, both in the leadership and in middle class life. So what did they do? Enormous investment in secondary, tertiary education, vocational training. Spain particularly. Now, one in three students goes to higher education, and that was just a tiny number who were enjoying tertiary education back in the 1970s. Again, Lee Kuan Yew, enormous investment into training the top leadership, the middle leadership, and an expanding middle class. And not just by sending people to the best universities in the world, really thinking about tailoring an education system domestically, right down to how many carpenters, woodworkers, electricians, plumbers are we going to need, and mapping out how to bring them online. So these were some of the patterns that we saw. The last one was one we hadn't expected to see. And this was a decision to create a domestic construction industry. When the leaders of Spain were discussing their entry into the European Union, they said, look, we knew that there was all that money sitting in Brussels in those structural funds. And they said, we'd be damned if we were going to let those Brussels bureaucrats come and run this for us and give the contracts to firms from other countries. They said, we're going to build the capacity. We're going to set up teams of engineers to design us fabulous projects that we can be proud of. And we're going to create a Spanish construction industry. And they did. And the Spanish construction industry is now really one of the global competitors winning bids even in the US to do construction. The same in Singapore. Lee Kuan Yew deliberately set out to create a domestic construction industry and thought about all the pieces, the building blocks of how you put that together, right from lease financing and mortgage financing and savings and loans, so the financing was in place, making sure that the equipment was there, and investing in training entrepreneurs to create that industry. And what we find is creating this industry is really important because not only does it create huge numbers of jobs, it creates management positions in small and medium-sized companies, which give people pride, and it gives people a stake in the system. And what did they build? They built the infrastructure and the housing that, again, underpinned the growth of their economy and the housing to house the middle class. So a very, very circular system that seemed to work. And we saw this in all these countries. We think that all these four attributes of successful transition are indispensable for how we approach the Iraqs, Afghanistan, Somalia, Liberia, Haiti. And in particular, one of the findings that we've come to, actually since finishing this book, is it's actually not a question of aid. Some countries need an injection of aid, as Spain and Ireland use these structural funds, for example. And even Lee Kuan Yew in Singapore used World Bank loans. So often they need a little bit of money to get going. But often these countries have enormous amounts of unspent money in their own budgets. And it's just been in the news, of course, that Iraq has had $6 billion of its own money unspent last year because it couldn't spend it. So they've had to write... Well, all these billions of dollars have been coming in aid from externally, the $6 billion that was sitting in Iraq's budget that they couldn't spend. Once we noticed this, we've been looking at other countries. It's the same in Haiti. can only spend 20% of its budget every year. Every year there's 80% of the budget that goes unspent. The same in Nepal, the same in Liberia. So we've got to focus, we argue, much more, instead of countries raising enormous sums of money in these big donor conferences that then go unspent. Why don't we start really focusing on how do countries spend their own money, which is what each of these cases of successful transition did. So we looked at these cases, and what we set out in this book is a framework. And what we thought it would be important to look at, what exactly does the state do in the 21st century? And when we started asking people, people said, oh, that's a really interesting question, we don't know. In fact, whether it was in the UK and France, people said, we don't know really what the state does for us in the 21st century, particularly in an era of globalization. And based on consultations across the world and looking at what the state actually does do in the modern world, we've suggested the 10 functions that the state should perform. We probably should have said 9 or 11, but we came with 10. We then convened a conference of the 12 leaders of post-conflict transitions of the last years, and we said, look, if you had this map of the functions that you needed to create, would this have been useful for you? And they said, absolutely. We could have saved 5 years because we didn't know we needed to do X and Y and Z. I won't list them all here, but one of them is, the traditional one is the monopoly on the means of force, on the use of force, which is the one that Max Weber described. But we go through the others. A functioning public finance system is absolutely critical. The rule of law, investing in human capital, so health and education, infrastructure services. It's not rocket science. It's very obvious when you see it. But people have said they haven't had this map before them. And particularly, the one that I think people forget about most when they're facing rebuilding their country after war is the market dimension. That's why we're so thrilled to be embarking on this partnership with Aspen. We find that there are sort of usually two ways that people look at the market in a post-conflict condition. One argument seems to be, look, just get the state out of the way and the market will flourish, the economy will flourish. The other argument seems to be, well, that's all very important, but we have other things to do first. We've got a humanitarian situation here. So we can focus on the market and the economy sort of 5 or 6 years down the road. I was at a meeting of peace negotiators a couple of years back at the United States Institute of Peace, and all of them looked at each other in horror and said, oh my goodness, we forgot about the market. And what happened? A criminal mafia elite came into play. And then they took back over the government, and the country went back into war. So we figure it's really important to think about what are the building blocks of a functioning market, what needs to be put into place, particularly to create a legitimate set of actors, private sector actors, who have a stake in stability, who have an interest in stability, and will put pressure on the government to exercise, to build a rule of law system, to build an openly competitive system. So we have a framework, and then we discuss a few ways that this framework could be put into action and could be supported by the international community. And the first thing that we argue is that we should have something called a double compact. And this was put into practice in Afghanistan in the form of the Afghan Compact, which was a compact between international actors and the government to follow a series of steps over time. Now, the problem with the Afghan Compact is that it's only half a compact, because it's between the international community and the government. Why a double compact? We say that there ought to be a similar compact between the government and its people, and that's possibly the most important part of the compact, and that's why the double compact. And we're arguing that what we need is some kind of what we call a sovereignty strategy or a state-building strategy, a plan that'll last 10 or 15, 20 years, with a lot of flexibility built into it, but there needs to be some kind of vision and agreement on the steps that need to be taken over time. And not too complicated. So the Bonn Agreement that we created, which is a little bit like this platform, which was too short, it was only 2.5 years, we argued that it should have been 5 or 10 years, really only had, it was very simple, it had one thing to do every 6 months that brought people together around achieving that objective. So the first thing that people had to do was to hold an emergency Lloyd-Jager. And then they had to hold a constitutional Lloyd-Jager to decide on their constitution. And the thing about that was it brought everybody together to agree on the rules of the game. What we find in many countries is that the International Committee just simply overloads the leadership of the country. So we sat with John Garang in southern Sudan shortly after he was just about to become president of South Sudan and vice president of Sudan. And he sat behind a desk looking rather despondent. And he said, you know, I've got the comprehensive peace agreement. It's about 2,000 pages. I've got the JAM, the joint assessment mission of the donors, another few thousand pages. I've got the humanitarian plan, the USAID plan, the Japanese plan, the security plan. He said, I don't know where to start. I've got to take 1,000 decisions a day. So it literally had disabled him. And what we chatted with him about was, well, instead of having all these thousands of decisions, how do you really focus on taking one big decision or achieving one thing that's irreversible every 2 or 3 months? And so we think that a sovereignty strategy would look at this. What do you need to do first? Do you need to build an army or a public finance system with payroll so you can pay that army? And what does a sequenced way of building a country look like? In the case of Iraq, how do you build a public finance system so that you get the expenditure of the $6 billion going properly to create jobs and then focus on other aspects? So this is the framework that we're arguing should be in place. So a double compact, a sovereignty strategy, and then a way of monitoring and changing these priorities over time. And this was really the basis, as I explained, of what was put in place in Afghanistan in part. So the Bonn Agreement provided the political platform. Then there was the budget, the change of the currency that enabled the money to be used, the building of a budget and a treasury system and a payroll system to pay the civil servants on time, creating that sense of predictability that things were back to normal, and so that you could expect them to work hard as well. And then building these programs, like the National Solidarity Program, that get block grants out to the people. And that we describe as something we call a national program. So instead of having these thousands of disparate projects, how do you have national programs that have a sense of justice and fairness and equality, so that if you're in a village, you know that you're entitled to a block grant of $20,000, and that you're going to have a health system and an education system with a national curricula, and so on. So we argue that these national programs could become the instrument of reestablishing policy and proper implementation. And not that the government should sort of Soviet style do all the implementation. These programs are really sort of platforms, collaborative platforms, so that different actors can play a role. Another example was the health system in Afghanistan. The government sets the policy or the standards of healthcare and then contracts out to NGOs to provide the services to that level. But that way you make sure that there aren't 10 NGOs in one province and none in the next, that they're actually contracted to provide a level of service. So finally, what next? My colleagues and I have set up a new organization, which Elliot mentioned, the Institute for State Effectiveness, which is trying to bring reformers together from places like Spain and Singapore and network them to the people who are really facing transitions at the moment. There was a wonderful woman who was made an Afghan woman who at age 27, became director of treasury in Afghanistan. And she said she got more out of spending 3 days in Iran and 3 days in Singapore with her counterparts, asking them, how did you do that, than $100 million worth of technical assistance of people coming telling her what to do. So we think one of the things that needs to happen is a network of, well, to codify how do you build institutions and then network people together so that they can learn from them. And we're going to be trying to decode and create manuals and toolkits through multimedia platforms, hopefully not just reports that sit on the shelves, of how do you build a finance ministry? How do you build a health system? And put that knowledge into the hands of reformers so that they don't have to spend $100 million every time they want to ask a question, but this knowledge is readily available to them with examples of how it's done in different countries. The Institute, I hope, will make a small contribution, but the issue is much, much, much bigger. And I will close with two reflections, and I think we've got time for discussion. One is Afghanistan. With the near fall of Peshawar to the Taliban last week, I think Afghanistan really is coming back, sadly, onto the front pages of the newspapers. And I do believe that Afghanistan and Pakistan are probably the most serious foreign policy issue right now. Iraq will take its own course, but Afghanistan is at a turning point, and we can get it horribly wrong and see it descend back to collapse and take over by the Taliban, or we can take some really smart decisions collectively and put it back on a path to peace. And I think we mustn't give up on it. Unlike Iraq, the population of Afghanistan is exhausted. They've had now nearly 30 years of war. And if you go out into the villages, people don't want the fighting to continue. And one thing I've been interminably surprised about is the extent to which people across the country still want a partnership with the West. They want a partnership, particularly with the US. But they're getting pretty annoyed about how NATO, the UN, the UN agencies, the NGOs are running things. And I think these things can be corrected. They'll take a lot of political will. And then more broadly, the question of whether one calls it failed states or state building or reform of development assistance is something that's really urgent. And I hope and wish that the presidential candidates will be really smart about it and put it on their agenda and take reform, particularly of the aid system and the UN system, very, very seriously. I'll stop there.
This all sounds so wonderfully organized and logical. I don't understand how, through all these years, we've been muddling in the other directions, and it almost sounds like a lot of these foreign contractors are like what we would call pork in this country. And, I mean, you set up a wonderful system. Why hasn't somebody else looked at this over the ages?
I think that's a great question, and it's one I've been absolutely puzzled about. I think partly it is because this aid system that we have has developed piecemeal over the years. Even the Foreign Assistance Act, which I believe was set up in the 60s in this country, has been amended hundreds and hundreds of times, with people adding a little bit here and a little bit there. So what we're left with is this labyrinth of different rules that just doesn't make sense anymore. The same with the UN system. If you go back to the original UN documents, they look wonderful. And what's happened over time is people have added this UN agency and this UN agency. So it's become an incredibly complex system. And then as new donors have come on board, they've each developed their own set of rules. And so it's then piled it on top. So when you get to a country context, if you're the Minister of Finance, and if Ashraf was sitting here, he'd say he's spent about 80% of his time just trying to coordinate all the donors, rather than focus on leading and reform within the country. And when we talk to ministers of finance in other countries as well, they say they spent 80% of the time just trying to work out what the different rules are. So I don't think it's not a conspiracy and it's not malice. It's just the way that the system has developed over time. And then, as you say, there is certainly an element of pork in it, both in this country and in many others. The interests of the contractors and the amount they spend on lobbying and trying to get the contracts has just grown out of proportion and out of control. And trying to reform this system is going to be quite tricky. Both the it's not just the contractors, it's many of the NGOs as well, which have really become contractors. And I think one useful distinction to make with NGOs is there are a number of NGOs that are advocacy organizations. But many of them have just become contractors. They're not very different from a Lewis Berger or Halliburton, if all they're doing is taking contracts to build hundreds of schools or clinics. So I think that's the second problem. On the logical nature of it, I think absolutely, when we've talked to the business community about the framework we're proposing, the response we get is, but that's not rocket science, it's so obvious. Isn't it done like that already? And people can't believe that the reconstruction, peace-building industry isn't done to in this way or a similar way. And I think part of the problem is that the people who are put on the ground, whether designing peace agreements or working as reconstruction advisors, don't have any training. You know, they come up maybe through their bureaucracies, they get put there as ambassadors, but they haven't had even the most basic training in how these systems work.
Is the appropriate leadership team. And in many countries, maybe nothing has been happening so far because the leaders are not there. Are there any understanding, any framework, any methodology of how to build the elite in the countries where the leaders are not there?
I think that's a fantastic question, and I think it would be an incredibly important research project for somebody to take on. We've got as far in this book as identifying this leadership factor as absolutely critical, and notice the absence of it. I think looking further into under what conditions does a leadership team arise, and how can one catalyze the emergence of such a team, be a very, very important thing to look at. I don't have the answer. Thanks very much for raising that, and I think we haven't given it enough attention in the book. As to why it's not happening in Afghanistan specifically, I don't know. I think the new minister, Hanif Atmar, is a systems thinker, so I hope he will move to look at this. I think it's an illustration of exactly why it's so important that an education system, a health system, needs to work as a system, and all the pieces need to be there. Otherwise, the whole thing doesn't work. And so we have to make sure that the whole system works. As I understand it, in many parts of the world, textbook production distribution are one of the key areas of corruption. Because so much money is involved, you can just reprint them year after year, and people make a lot of money out of it. So I don't know if that's happening there. Yes. But I think absolutely thinking much more, and this is why I think the business community has so much to contribute to these situations with this type of analysis. How do you get the procurement systems, the supply chain systems, the distribution systems working? And we need logisticians. I mean, somebody's done this for a Unilever or Procter & Gamble or a large corporation. It's that type of thinking that needs to be put into play to get these systems working. Great question. I think it could come from a number of different places. It could come from within some of our international organizations. So, for example, a Bob Zelig leading the World Bank, or a group of people who come together and maybe decide, look, in these five countries, we're going to pilot a different way, create a success story, and then see it replicated. I've seen actually just some of the things that were successfully done in Afghanistan have now been replicated in a lot of other countries. Success breeds a lot of copying, which is great. So perhaps piloting in five countries, getting a group of leaders together around it. I think potentially the US foundations or global foundations could play a role. So were a Rockefeller, a Hewlett, I don't think it's Gates's core priority at the moment because the organization doesn't want to work in post-conflict countries at the moment. But a group of leading foundations could come together and pilot a different approach. And it could come from a group of leaders on the ground, I think. I mean, there are a number of countries. I mean, Eritrea sent all the donors away. That kind of didn't work in the end for other reasons. But I think often if a leadership of a country has the strength to say, you know, this, to formulate their own vision, say, this is how we're going to do things, and have the courage to turn around to the aid system and say, no, these are our rules. If you obey these rules, you can help us. But if not, we don't want your assistance. And I think that's what it's going to take. The other dimension here is, I think, a very interesting one. I think of all the governmental actors at the moment, it's actually the security community that understands this the best. And the leadership of Robert Gates in the Pentagon is very interesting. He's said, look, we have to get this right. I think the security community is coming to a realization that the aid system, before they thought civil-military cooperation, we clear an area and then the aid system comes in and makes it all perfect. They're realizing now that that doesn't happen. And the security community are realizing that we have to get state building right and that the aid system is currently broken. So I think they can be a very powerful voice for change, even though I think they're realizing they don't want to be doing it themselves on the ground. Absolutely. I think it is in the timeline, in any kind of timeline for any country, it's one of the first things you do. So when we were talking to John Garang, we said, look, you've got to get your oil industry properly managed. Otherwise, the North will clean you out. So why don't you take 5,000 South Sudanese, do a deal with the Norwegians and other countries that know how to manage their oil properly, and get them into training now. So absolutely. I think vocational training, one of the first things that need to be looked at. Often, rather like the rules for the economy, people say, oh, that can wait till later. But then you go on waiting years and years as your country goes back into civil war. And I think what I'd recommend is, what you need to do is look at how many doctors, teachers, engineers, finance managers, carpenters. So you almost do a matrix of what kind of skills you want and need. And then you have some short-term measures before you can get an education system up and running domestically. Ask neighboring countries. So countries like, for example, India, South Africa, in Malaysia, have an enormous capability in their own universities to absorb people from other countries. So you could do deals with those kind of countries. Some people can come to the US, to European schools. So absolutely, you do essentially a plan. How quickly can you get your own institutions up and running? And in the meantime, which other countries will help to educate people? And then the trick is, I think the difficult part there is, when people go to other countries, are they going to come back again? So some kind of rules, like probably the Fulbright scholarship, which say if you take this scholarship, you must go back and serve for at least 3 years.
Early in your remarks, you talked about the warlords and the problems of the warlords, and also that they were being paid. Who was paying them would be a separate interesting issue. But does the implementation of a system like you're devising require a certain level of public safety? And how is that public safety going to be provided? Is it from NATO or from the U.S. or from, even if it's the Taliban? But you've still got the Taliban to worry about using Afghanistan, or a very good example that's very much in the news right now is Zimbabwe. There is no public safety, and how can you have a country run and implement all of these things when you've got active people trying to combat what you're doing?
Great point. I think absolutely. Often there's a case for the deployment of foreign soldiers to keep and maintain the peace. And whether that's sometimes US forces or forces from the UK or other countries or within the guise of NATO or under the guise of the UN and its peacekeeping, there are many different institutional arrangements can be there. But absolutely, sometimes they are required to keep the peace. What went wrong in Afghanistan, I think, was that these people were here, but they didn't use their presence and their power, their symbolic power, to break the power of the local warlords. So it's really a question of how they're deployed in that short-term time. I think also that it's becoming clear that there isn't enough force in the world to keep the peace by repression. And this is why we're arguing that it's actually the other 9 functions out of the 10 that really need to be there to create a legitimate order which the people buy into. It's when the people trust their government that they won't have the incentive to join insurgencies and so on. which is why it's really the emphasis on how quickly can you really create a pathway where the population can see, can have hope in the future, that will be the real source of security and stability. And for example, where this National Solidarity Program is in operation, we've got evidence that people don't go to the Taliban. And when asked, they say, why? Is this a government institution? Why is that? And they say, no, it's not a government institution. It's our institution, this council. But, you know, through it, we can speak to the government. I think we're out of time, so I should let you all go on to the next. Thank you.